I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast,
we talk to Tom Hamilton about PMQs.
We discuss whether or not there'll be another election.
And we ask ourselves, is the media in trouble or better than ever? Stephen, I'm very excited that we've been joined in the podcast Bunkerette. Actually, our last episode before we moved to our swanky new offices, complete with their podcast suite.
Let's downplay expectations. Room, a podcast room, and yeah, we'll...
With walls, maybe a floor even, who can say. But joining us is Tom Hamilton. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
You worked for the Labour Party for quite a long time, worked most recently in Tom Watson's office. You've now written a book, Punch and Judy Politics, with Aisha Hazarika. And we're going to talk about Prime Minister's questions later, and actually how various Labour people come off in the book. But first of all, Stephen, tell me about this madness about the early election. There's not going to be an early election, is there, please?
I mean, I don't know, because I have this problem that there are two hypotheticals, neither of which I can really convince myself of. So the first is that Brexit can be successfully negotiated with the House of Commons as it is currently constituted, with the government's red lines as they presently exist, without at some point there being a collision between what the executive and the legislature want. I can't convince myself that will happen, but equally I can't convince myself that the Conservatives would look at a slightly mouldy economy, a poll lead which is considerably smaller than the one they went into the
when they threw away last time
election, and an electoral map which is not kind. You know, there are an awful lot of places, yeah, like Cheadle, where there are 10,000 Labour votes in third place, the Lib Dems in a much closer than 10,000 second place. I just cannot see how the Conservative Party looking at that would go, yep, I feel lucky. But the problem is at that point, what I'm saying is I can't believe either of the possible scenarios. And so I just don't know. I think it's a lot more possible than people think.
Tom, how fun would you say the last election was from the inside on a scale of 1 to 10?
I would say more than one, actually. Maybe three or four. It was... you know, it got me out of the house and out of the office, and you know, I got to do slightly different things from usual. It was not the sort of campaign that, during the campaign, knocking on doors, you thought there's definitely going to be. You know, the polls are, didn't feel like the polls were wrong until the exit poll from the doors that I was knocking on.
More, it was so comparative to 2015, where the polls were overstating Labour. Where was it compared to that?
I think 2015 was, in many ways, a terrifying campaign because there were loads of plausible outcomes in which we could win and also plausible outcomes in which we couldn't. 2017 was easier in lots of ways because it didn't feel like there was any plausible outcome in which we could win. The result was it exceeded almost everybody's expectations. You know, one or two people claimed that Labour was actually going to win and, you know, put money on it, but they didn't win either, to be fair.
Stephen and I were talking about this earlier, because my problem with that campaign is obviously immediately this being the left descended into like a, oh, you didn't believe enough, oh, you, yeah, oh, the MSM, they don't know what they're talking about. And I think there was a very interesting critique about why people didn't call that election right. Stephen wrote a piece about Jeremy Corbyn surging the polls. I think you were one of the few. Was that piece greeted with as much scepticism as your Jeremy Corbyn is surging in the 2015 Labour leadership polls piece?
I think actually, both more and less. So with the Corbyn is winning in the polls, obviously, is a source of ongoing bitterness that people who know who they are responded to that story knowing full well that it was true in a... There was a lot more...
This is 2015.
There was a lot more performative, I cannot believe you have written this disgusting fictional story about something I know 100% is happening from my own campaign's data. Whereas, I mean, in an act of cowardice that I still occasionally do wake up at night feeling guilty about, you will notice that I changed the headline on one of those, he's actually doing better than think, to from going, yeah, actually, Jeremy Corbyn is having a much better campaign than we all think, to there is one place where Labour's campaign is strong, radio, which is one of those things which just is a kind of bit of sort of kind of just going, okay, maybe I'll just go back into my box. I occasionally do kind of feel guilty about it, whereas I never did go back and edit, you know, kind of edit the headline of the Corbyn is going to win the Labour leadership according to this leaked poll to Corbyn, you know, who knows, maybe, you know, Corbyn candidate in Labour leadership, which is basically, so I guess therefore it was more venomous. I think the weird thing in terms of if there isn't another election is that we know that Labour's own voter ID did not tell them whereas in 2015, as you'll know better than I do, then although you had that line about we don't recognise these numbers, we think they're not true.
I wrote that email. I pressed send on that email at least.
but my understanding is that you did all recognise those numbers and that they were fairly consistent with what you'd been hearing throughout the day.
Well, I was not in the field ops team, so it wasn't my job to be analysing the numbers. But on the day, actually, people were quite optimistic on the day that turnout was looking better in our areas than it might have done. And people, you know, that made the exit poll, if anything, more of a shock than it would have been otherwise. I think one of the great things about 2017 was the sort of the schadenfreude moment as someone who'd been on the wrong side of an unexpectedly bad exit poll on election night 2 years earlier, imagining what it must be like in Tory HQ and frankly feeling no sympathy whatsoever for them.
Yeah, there's some great descriptions of that in Tim Shipman's book, and you just think,
In 2015, I don't remember anyone actually being sick in a bucket, but...
that's a new good low bar. What worries me about the prospect of another early election, apart from the fact it makes me want to kill myself having to go through that again, because I can't eat that many Doritos again, Stephen, that's what mostly I'm worried about, is the fact is I'm not sure that as political journalists we're quite ready in our coverage of it. Both in the sense of, I mean, I think it's fair criticisms about not seeing the result coming. My response to that has always been, what data should we have been looking at? Like, what, you know, why should we have taken the YouGov seat modelling a lot more seriously than the headline polling figures? Like, what's the scientific rationale for that? What can we learn for that? But also, I'm not sure whether or not, next time we cover an election, I want us to be really, really clear about not treating one outcome as the expected one and then working back from that. Because the last two elections, both the idea that obviously the Tories will win, it's about whether Labour can get more seats or polls or what percentage points, that was a bad way of covering that election. The 2015, will they have to do a deal with the SNP, meant that we just didn't ask a load of questions. The EU referendum, I remember commissioning you for our EU referendum special where you wrote some kind of crazy pie in the sky piece about like what's the difference between the Canada model and WTO and the Swiss model, as if this was like kind of like whether or not we should buy a unicorn or not. And it turns out that actually that was a conversation we absolutely should have been pushing and having much more. And really difficult when you're being spun by the parties and everybody is sort of, but that kind of teleological view of elections where you just assume that you know what's going to happen and you ask all your questions predicated on that outcome. That's the thing that annoys me, that, you know, maybe less than other people, I definitely gave into it.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And I definitely feel it's something that I got wrong too. The thing I would like there to be another election because I love elections and also...
Doritos.
I love elections and I'm not that keen on this government, but as of course is everyone else in this room. But
don't you think we might have another election that might essentially produce exactly the same result again, or an even more hung parliament?
Well, so yeah, I mean,
but, that's the trouble, is we could have an infinite number of new elections. At what point do you stop loving elections?
Well, so I mean, I'm willing to find out. My concern is that in terms of the things I think I got wrong in 2017, I would ideally like to have some more local elections and by-elections in order to have stress tested some of those things a bit. So the interesting thing about this set of local elections is it suggests the kind of realignment of voting behaviour, Portsmouth no longer being a weird city which ought to vote Labour but somehow doesn't, and it just did vote Labour both in the general election and in the local election. So some of the stuff which we weren't sure about at the general election, like is how much of this is just a weird fluke, it doesn't seem from the local election in 2018 than it was. I would ideally like to have had some more local elections so I could, you know, test some of my assumptions about it. I know for a fact that everyone who works for a political party would quite like to have some more local elections to work out if the things they post-mortemed were better.
One of the big things that stuffed us last time was, what, Labour getting 27% in the immediately preceding local elections. Yeah. And then I remember you writing these blogs going, it would be the first time that a party has ever outperformed its whatever. And it turns out, yes, indeed, it was the first time that a party had outperformed its local election performance immediately prior to an election.
But I think the thing is, although both when it's been held in the run-up and in the year before, no party has ever done that before, I think the local elections still were very useful because they, if someone to travel back in time and said, look, Labour will get 260-odd seats, you know, guess them from the 2017 local elections, you actually would have been able to have quite a good stab at it because you would have gone, oh, right, so they'll do significantly better in cities and university towns, which would then lead you to go, oh, so Canterbury, Kensington, and they're doing worse in the West Midlands in particular, which would then make you go, oh, maybe they will be in trouble in one of the Stoke seats, maybe they will lose Mansfield. So even that local election, which didn't tell us about the level of support, was quite useful. But also, because this is the first election surprise I've covered where all the sides were equally shocked. In 2015, the Lib Dems knew that they had a big problem with the SNP, and then it was allowing the Tories to go, the only way to stop that is to vote for us. And they knew they had a big problem in the Southwest. They had no idea how to stop it, but which kind of meant that there was at least one number where one of the three parties involved went, yep, that's unfortunately what we were expecting. The weird thing about 2017 is none of the parties, even the ones who didn't believe their own numbers, none of them were expecting this from what their own numbers were telling them. And so they would all quite like, in ideal circumstances, to go into the next election in better shape. But, as you say, the other possibility, right, is that we've got used to this idea that you have a hung parliament and then you have a convenient party called the DUP or the Lib Dems who exactly add up to the number you need to have a majority, a big one in the case of the Lib Dems and a teeny tiny one in the case of the DUP. Whereas you could just have, I mean, let's say the DUP go down to even 8 seats, which would still be a historically very good performance for them. And then the Tories lose 4 seats to Labour and the Lib Dems combined. Again, perfectly plausible. Probably the upper limit of what you would expect them to lose. Well, then suddenly you have a situation in which...
Can I say the words irrevocably hung?
Yeah. I mean, that is, you know...
It's
yeah.
just a good phrase. I like saying it. moving extremely swiftly on from that, Tom, your book is about PMQs. It's been a long-running contention of this podcast that neither Theresa May nor Jeremy Corbyn are particularly good at PMQs. I think Stephen was the first to write that, you know, particularly the way that Corbyn approaches them is about kind of getting clips out for Facebook. So he wants to land a really good attack rather than actually necessarily asking a question and expecting an answer. But in your time working with people, who is the best at PMQs? Like, who would you rate as? I mean, everyone says Blair.
Well, that's before my time.
Before
working
your
with,
time,
with
but
people.
Like,
I mean, if you want
you
to,
must have studied lots of PMQs.
Yeah,
is what
so
I'm saying.
Best of all time would probably be Hague and Blair, who were both very good at what they were doing. In my time, of the people I worked with, there are so few of them that saying who the best and worst one starts to become very obvious. So if I could sort of go a bit left field and say that I did a couple of PMQs with Angela Eagle and she was very good indeed. It's a hipster choice. I think, you know, the time that I was working on PMQs with Jeremy was quite early on in his time, and he has improved quite significantly since then. So, you know, getting rid of me from the PMQ team is clearly a good move. But there are lots of reasons why he has improved. I was there during the period when he was doing a lot of crowdsourced questions, which I think was a sensible approach for him at that time, early on. Not a lot of no dispatch box experience at all. And also using those crowdsourced questions as a way of sort of dramatising what he was trying to do in his election campaign as well, which was to say, I want to be the voice of real people against a sort of a closed elite circle by reading those questions out. The downside of it was that they were generally not very difficult questions.
Yeah, I like that era. I think as a stopgap, kind of going, I've got a question from, you know, Rachel from Wolverhampton, because you could just see the sort of panic of like, you know, and you couldn't then dismiss that as being a kind of, you know, because you just don't know when it's going to, the end of that sentence is going to be she's got cancer and her, you know, her treatment's fallen through or whatever. So I think it got him out of a hole, but you're right. They were quite easy to bat away.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, we spoke to lots of people for the book, but so we asked David Cameron about it, and he said that he found that, you know, those particular questions really easy because he could just sort of step back. The question would be something like, why are you doing this thing? And he'd say, well, let me explain to you why we're doing this thing. And they just weren't very political questions. Mm. And there was no sort of, one of the things you're trying to do when you construct a set of six PMQs questions is a sort of a moving argument that narrows down on what the problem is. And it's very difficult to do that with isolated individual questions sent in by people. You can still sometimes do it if you've got enough questions on one topic, but I don't recall that ever really happening very effectively.
Yeah, the one of the many really interesting things about the book is that you realise through reading it, the way that one of the things PMQs has done is it has made the whole of Whitehall more accountable to the centre, because as you outlined, the fact that the Prime Minister now can be asked anything. So this is the fascinating thing. When it was first introduced in 61... although there's a fun argument about when it was first introduced, which again...
Is that like, who's the first British Prime Minister? It's one of those, like, never asked this in a pub quiz.
Yeah. There's a really interesting bit in which kind of explains... but when, in the 70s, kind of Callaghan started and then Margaret Thatcher formalised, but up until that point, the Prime Minister would basically be able to go like, I refer you to the Home Secretary on that one. And I suppose the reason why Callaghan started doing that, I suspect, will have been about the difficult parliamentary arithmetic and a desire to hold.
Yeah, I mean, there are two linked developments in the 70s, which culminates in Thatcher saying, I'm going to take all of the questions myself, which does accumulate a huge amount of power in Number 10, because then they have to know everything that's going on in government in order to answer questions about anything. But that builds from the development of the open question, where nearly all questions of PMQs now are, can the Prime Minister tell me her engagements for the day, which is not a very interesting question, but that then enables you to put in a supplementary about absolutely anything. So once that becomes common in the mid to late 70s, it's less and less useful for the Prime Minister to say, I want to actually refer that to the Health Secretary or whoever, because she doesn't know or he doesn't know what's coming. So those two developments sort of go together. And by the early 80s, Thatcher is using PMQs as a means of controlling her whole government by making sure that all that briefing comes into the centre, and then she can go back and say, this isn't good enough, I need to change this answer, I'm happy with this answer. And that's carried on ever since. And you can see that, you know, we spoke to people who'd helped to prepare prime ministers for PMQs, who talked about the way in which you have a whole team in Number 10 that's responsible just for getting all this information in, for making sure that all the departments are keeping on top of what the problems are. If you get asked about this, here's the right answer. And it's important for them too, because if the Prime Minister doesn't know the right answer and gives the wrong answer, that can then be, it's bad for the Prime Minister, but it can be quite catastrophic for the government department as well, who might end up having to change a policy they didn't want to change or deal with a problem in a way they wouldn't have wanted to deal with.
How can we end the plague of friendly backbenchers asking idiot questions about, like, will the Prime Minister agree with me that the much-needed investment in Gorsford Town Centre's shopping mall?
I think you can't for several different reasons at once. One is that, to an extent, the most effective tactic for making people not do it is shame. And while some people
feel shame,
don't do it, some others do not. And you know, there's only so much you can do to persuade someone who doesn't see a political downside to asking a really easy question to not ask it. Also, it's very much in the government's interest that that happens. One of the advisors we spoke to said that having planted backbench questions turns PMQs from 30 minutes of hell into 15 minutes of hell, which is quite a big deal for a prime minister. And, you know, it's a way of the government getting its message across. So if you do have a really easy question along the lines of, in my day when I was working on it, they've changed the rhetoric a bit now, but, you know, doesn't the latest inflation figure show that the government's long-term economic plan is working, to which the answer is yes, it is. It gets that long-term economic plan soundbite out there and reminds everyone what the government's message is in a way that the Prime Minister wants. Would it be better for everybody if Tory backbenchers were constantly trying to embarrass the Prime Minister with difficult questions they hadn't prompted Number 10 with? It would be brilliant, but I don't see a way of making that happen.
In terms of this, whenever I've been to the House and watched PMQs, the thing that I think you don't even get from TV, because it's all that weird kind of fishbowl effect with all the galleries around it, which obviously the cameras don't pick up, and then the wall of noise, just the like, I just don't think that, apart from going to like a football match, there's not really that many times when you just experience suddenly that kind of assault, that kind of sonic assault. What other things do people probably not get about PMQs? What did you find out in the course of both working on it and talking to other people about it?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. You're right about the chamber and the noise. And part of that, one of the things that goes alongside that is that a lot of what people are saying, you can't hear. So, you know, the individual comments that people make, the heckles, are things that if you're there on the front bench, you can hear it, but the microphones don't pick it up. Often the speaker doesn't hear it. Tony Blair told us a story about how he was answering PMQs one day and someone on the other side yelled out, "His flies are undone." And microphones don't pick that up. You obviously, if you're standing up looking forward, you cannot tell whether that's true or not. You just have, it puts you off your stride, but you have to wait till you sit down until you can check. It's an absolutely brilliant heckle. Those sorts of things, you've got to brazen it out at that point. The other thing that people, I think, don't realise, and there's a lot of criticism of PMQs, and a lot of it is valid because a lot of it is quite silly, is it touches on what Stephen was talking about earlier about the way that PMQs helps prime minister to control government. It helps both sides to think through, if they're using it properly, I think, it helps both sides to think through their strategic messaging. What can we ask about? Not just what can we ask about because it's a big story, but what can we ask about safely? What are the areas where, if we ask this question about something we care about, actually she's got a really good comeback, either because we've got a split on our side, or because our policy isn't actually very well worked out, or because the NHS in Wales isn't being run the same way as the NHS in England, or because we can't afford to pay for anything to deal with the problem we've got. A good leader's office will have anticipated those problems and either avoided the question or made a political decision that it's worth going on and asking those questions anyway because the prize is great enough and you should be asking about this topic. But as Alistair Campbell used the phrase strategic anvil. Tony Blair used it as a strategic anvil to work out, you know, what they needed to be focused on, what their best messages were, what their best criticisms of the government were, how to boil down. So much of politics is about boiling down really complex bits of information into one or two sentences, five or six words. And, you know, we can resent that and regret it. And, you know, it's the dumbing down of politics and it's anti-intellectual and all these things. But it's also, you know, when you've got a population that is not paying as much attention to politics as the listeners of the New Statesman podcast, you do need to be able to have a message that will resonate in a very few words. And PMQs is one of the places where that really has to happen.
Yeah, I think about quite a lot. I interviewed a couple of years ago, John Lloyd, who's the producer, TV producer on things like QI and Not the 9 o'clock News and the News Quiz. And he spoke about doing, he did The Meaning of Lif with Douglas Adams and about performing it live. And he said, I did what good stand-ups do, which is I use the audience as an editor. You know, the audience is a genius. They know what's funny. And I think there's a similar thing with PMQs about, you know, you can tell by the kind of the thickening of the atmosphere in the room what has wounded someone. Yeah. Like as a kind of test bed for that, there's no other time for it. Much as though I hate lots of the mooing and all the that business, like as a kind of, as a laboratory for messaging, I think it is quite interesting.
Yeah, you absolutely know whether you've won or lost based on the reaction of MPs on both sides. I mean, MPs will try and cheer for their side and, you know, boo the other side, whatever happens. But there's a different quality to the sound when they're doing it sincerely to when they're just trying to help out.
Are they ever laughing sincerely, though? That's the question.
I think they sometimes are, with the caveat that the jokes aren't always quite as good as people think. I mean, in the same way that, let's be honest, if you go to a stand-up show with, you know, this is no criticism of my co-author, who is a very successful stand-up comedian, some of the laughs come from the way that the atmosphere of a room can generate a laugh. The cadence of a sentence can get a laugh going. And a skilled performer, whether it's comedy or politics, can make that happen. And it doesn't mean that the laugh isn't genuine, but it means that it isn't necessarily a full reflection of the wittiness of the sentence.
It's more like a best man speech laugh, isn't it? And if you're laughing about your side, like you want to laugh. But also I think there's things that a PM, this is like your concept of people being Westminster hot. There's like PMQs funny.
Yeah, there is definitely PMQs. The interesting thing I think about that is the person who I think emerges as the person who's both thought the most about it, and also I hadn't quite realised how many really clever things that Haig used to do to discomfort Blair. Like one week he sat down having taken three of the questions, so Blair kind of was like, okay, well, that's over. It's a couple of backbench style questions, and then he stood up to ask the other set of questions. There'd be the kind of roving sort of like, here's a question, and you know, he would occasionally only take five of his questions, which obviously means the Prime Minister then can't do their the wicked Tories comeback, and it would mean all of the rest of the time Blair would know that maybe he needed to launch his attack early, but then you don't have anything to go on if he does go on a sixth question. The thing is, and William Hague lost the 2001 election appallingly badly.
Yeah. So Hague is really interesting because he's the first person to have six questions to ask at PMQs because the timetable shifted in 1997. Before that, it was three questions twice a week and then it went to six once a week. Hague spent a huge amount of time thinking about it because, I mean, he's very self-deprecating about it because he didn't have very much else to do. So, you know, they had, they'd lost the 97 election badly. You know, if you look at the benches in Parliament now, when the House is full, both sides are basically full. There were empty spaces on the Tory benches. There were so few people in the opposition because Labour had won so heavily in 1997. Hague was good at one thing, and that was debating, oratory, you know, parliamentary performance.
And drinking, of course.
Well, yeah, and that was something that that the Labour Party, you know, that was one of the many attacks that that resonated, was to talk about that more than perhaps anyone would have wanted. But he devoted a huge amount of time to just thinking through the tactics of PMQs, working out different techniques for asking questions, studying how Blair answered, studying the fact that Blair's, at one point he noticed that Blair's briefing was in two different folders, which were structured alphabetically. So he could ask a question about something that began with A, have Blair leaf through the folder to find the answer, and then ask another question
about
something beginning with A.
And they had, exactly. And they had names for the formations, you know, the kind of the roving thing. The Hague bits are far and away the best bit. It's a great book, but the Hague bits are, I think, far and away the best bit. Because
that's a very clever guy with a lot of time on his hands.
Yeah, the level of thought about it.
The point you make about him not winning is absolutely right. And I think it does show an important point about PMQs, which is, you know, it helps to test things. It helps to put the government on the spot, but it doesn't in itself change the overall strategic position, which in those days was that the Tories were in a bit of a mess. Labour really was dominant. It was broadly managing the country, you know, I think as a Labour person, pretty well. The country thought so too, and they re-elected them. But what Hague was able to do was to, you know, give the Tories a bit of pride, give them something to shout for every week, and give them a little bit of confidence in some of their own arguments. Of course, he was up against someone who was also very good at PMQs. You know, Blair was excellent at it, which is why those clashes were so good compared to some of the ones we've seen since. And I think very few people would say that the May-Corbyn clashes, whatever they think of May and Corbyn, they wouldn't say that those are the sort of all-time great PMQs encounters.
The other sort of interesting thing is that, obviously, as well as writing about the history of PMQs and now knowing an awful lot about that, you also briefed and prepared leaders for a long time. Is I hadn't quite realised how much the decisions taken and in some cases not taken by it have further codified it. Mm-hmm. There were huge amounts of debates about whether or not you would use all, yeah, whether or not you'd do the kind of, oh, we've only done five questions, so you can't do the same old Labour trick. Yeah. Has writing the book made you feel differently about your time doing it?
It's a good question. To which the answer, without having thought about it very much, is probably no. I mean, I think it's one of those things which, I don't want to get too autobiographical about it, but it's the sort of job that if you're interested in politics, you dream of being able to do. Not specifically, but it's exactly the sort of thing you'd love to end up working on. And when I was working on it, I always knew that it was an incredibly fortunate thing to be on, which is why, you know, the fact that it was also a lot of the time incredibly annoying was never something that made me want to stop doing it.
Why was it incredibly annoying?
The amount of time it took, the amount of going backwards and forwards on things, sometimes the fact that, especially in the early
people
days...
People didn't listen?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think one of the things about being an advisor is that you understand that your role is to advise and not to, you know... There's sometimes a bit of an advisor culture about, you know, actually I was the one that made this decision and actually this is all down to me and I'm the big guy. And there are lots of people on both sides who are responsible for that. In the end, and this is a point we try to get across in the book, is that the most important decision maker and strategic thinker in any political party ought to be the leader. Mm-hmm. And when it's functioning properly, it is the leader. The advisors have a role to play, and it would be better to have good ones than to have bad ones or not to have any. But, you know, leaders are really, really important. You know, but in the early days when we hadn't quite worked out how the diary was going to work and we wouldn't start a PMQs meeting until, you know, 7 or 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night, it would go until 11 o'clock, I'd get the train home, get up at 6 in the morning and be back in the room again. That didn't feel like, I didn't feel like I was living my best life at that point.
I have one more question, which is, do you either have a favourite PMQ's joke or question?
I'm slightly biased in the sense that the
To ones that you wrote.
To ones that I... Well, yeah.
Go on, it's fine. This is a safe space.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always... And again, this is a good illustration of the fact that these things don't matter very much, but it won in the week, and the week that we did it. You know, I was very proud of the... It's a PMQ's works in the room joke that doesn't work around the country, but the... Is there anything that you could organise in a brewery question, which was about minimum alcohol pricing, but it was really there to just say, you know, you're rubbish and incompetent. Why are you so rubbish? And that was a good example of a PMQ's that was successful because that first question was impossible to answer and Cameron never really knew how to get back. I mean, our best PMQ's was one that actually isn't even in the book, but where we just had a cumulative set of questions about, you know, what various broken promises, when he said it, did he mean it? Where if they hadn't done any of these things that they said they were going to do, it felt like a really successful thing on the day. It was, but it made absolutely no difference whatsoever to the final result of the election.
Well, there's a sad morality tale for everything, but a brilliant book, Punch and Judy Politics, An Insider's Guide to Prime Minister's Questions. Thank you for joining us, Tom Hamilton.
Thanks very much.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us!
Yes, finally! Oh, Stephen, this is the last time in the podcast bunker and you've, like, the opposite of christened it.
Yeah, I've learnt to love the You Ask Us format.
This makes me so happy. At Hoi Polloi... Actually, I'm going to say, the person's called Hoi Polloi. I can't even begin to untangle the jumble of consonants and vowels that their Twitter username is, has sent us You Ask Us suggestion, which is, how is the financing of media changing in Britain about paywalls, emergence of things like BuzzFeed as web-only, but, you know, doing investigative journalism? It depends on Facebook's algorithm. And this is a very good... talking about PMQ's planted questions, this isn't one, but it really ought to be, because this is the week that we've launched our paywall, which some of you may have seen, because Stephen needs to buy shoes.
It's true. That is the main reason why we've gone behind a paywall. So the interesting thing about this... So yesterday I was at the Drum Online Media Awards, which I did not win.
Were you nominated?
I was nominated, is the same as winning, right? The thing I thought was interesting is the deserved winner in another category was Uber Butler's piece about making his shed a TripAdvisor restaurant, right? Now, when three or four food writers gather together, they will slag off TripAdvisor because it's an appalling website that really bad restaurants, and it turns out a shed can gain. Now, that article, as well as being wittily written, just really well done, that ought to have been, in my view, the death of TripAdvisor as a business concern. Ditto, that excellent BuzzFeed story about HMRC going, oh, you know...
Lycamobile.
I'm sorry, that is the kind of thing which happens in a failed state. You know, like, that shouldn't happen in the United Kingdom. Right? Those were both, one is about food, one is about politics and corruption. But the interesting thing I think about new free media is the problem is there clearly is a snobbery in parts of the BBC and bits of the print press. And I do not believe for a moment if The Guardian had that Lycamobile story, I think it would have run onto the broadcasters and been picked up even by the right-wing press in ways, and it just wasn't because it was on BuzzFeed. And ditto, then TripAdvisor's, it's not like these problems with TripAdvisor's business model have not been discussed, but then they were proved in shed. I mean, there is a...
In shed
there
form.
Is, there is a literal shed. We can point, you know, whenever someone says, why are you snobbish about TripAdvisor? I say, by the way, here's one of the funniest articles you'll ever read. And also, this is why TripAdvisor is terrible.
I think one of the things we have to do when you consider the media, which often doesn't happen, is to consider it as an ecosystem and the way that it plays into each other. So one of the classic examples I always point to is, the Panama Papers. The Guardian reported on David Cameron's father having stuff in a trust. I don't know, it wasn't anything illegal, but it was, of note in that sense when we're talking about offshore stuff. And that got meh when it was first reported. And then it kind of came back round again in the run-up to the referendum. And suddenly, in my opinion, because lots of the right-wing papers were now opposed to the Tory government and their line on Europe rather than being pro them winning and beating Labour, it was picked up and became a much bigger story. And that's the same with the fact that I know places like BuzzFeed have argued very hard to get on the paper reviews. So on the Today programme, on the Mar programme, on all of these places that we spent a time lobbying to be on the Sky News and BBC paper reviews when they come out, because we are a current affairs title. And the way that that's, you know, I think the BBC has always faced, you know, questions about whether or not it leans to the right or the left. And I think it does different things at different times. But one of the things it does fill space on news programmes with paper reviews, and those papers cluster around a set of opinions, and that inevitably skews that debate. I think you can have opinions that are out on the right and still be within the mainstream fold. That's a far bigger stretch than there is currently on the left and what's considered to be radical on the left.
Well, this is the thing is, I have never been on air as, other than when like it's a, you know, piece about the Labour leadership, when there is an ongoing leadership election, I have never been on air as
centre-left rather than left.
As like a lefty, me on the centre-left, and then us being able to kind of tag team the person on the right. I am basically always, actually with the exception of Newsnight's three-pronged thing where I seem to flit between being on the centre or on the left, depending on who's booking me that week. That element of the ecosystem, just definitely, you're right, does not exist, right? You just end up in the situation where it's just like, I hear that you are a representative of everyone on the left, from Checks Notes, Tony Blair, to Jeremy Corbyn.
And that's a weird thing, which again I have, which is like when I do Women's Hour, it's often the only other time I'm on with another female political journalist. And that has been in the kind of 5 or so years I've been doing it slightly again. I bet the times when you're on with another ethnic minority journalist are vanishingly small, right? It's just...
Has that ever happened? Not that I can immediately call to mind.
Yeah, and so, you know, in terms of the booking, and those are deeper structural problems, not all about the people booking those panels, but I think, the chance of finding two different shades of right, and it's definitely happened during the EU referendum, right, is that you had to have a kind of right-wing Remainer, a right-wing Leaver, and then there was one other slot.
Yeah.
And which was all, you know, which was for the left. So actually then, weirdly, all the Leavers complained that they were being outnumbered, but all the left could equally complain that they were being outnumbered too.
I think that's why the Lycomobile story didn't get as much traction. It of course is part of why Labour anti-Semitism gets more traction than Pendle, although part of it, now I was about to say, is part of it Labour's rubbish response. And then I remembered that Labour's rubbish response is literally identical to Brandon Lewis's, like, oh, it was for this reason. Oh, it was a mistake. Oh, no, the solution is political education. But the Vice thing, I think, is an example of media snobbery. Okay, maybe it's just that other people don't care as much about food as I do.
I mean, you have got a cookery column. I think that ship has sailed. You can admit that.
But I do think it's a huge deal, and a website that people trust to provide them with good food and hotel recommendations.
You're saying like one of your adverts now. It's going to be really
really awkward when we get an email just being like, next week's advert is for TripAdvisor.
No, but you're right. I think you're right. If the Daily Mail had done a big, because whatever you say about the Daily Mail, it does big, hard-hitting consumer investigations and it's got a lot of warmth to deliver. If they had done that, then TripAdvisor would be bleeding on the floor and would have had to really think its policies, but it's more of a kind of flea bite when it comes from an online news source, because you just don't get those people piling in behind you.
And that is obviously a big problem for accountability. I mean, I think, I am optimistic that our paywall will be a success.
Well, I think in terms of the rationale behind it, I think it's really noticeable to me what you can and can't do on web budgeting and advertising rates. And pretty much everybody has come to that conclusion, right? So the Guardian's model is about membership. So that's asking for a decent chunk of money in addition to their display ads. BuzzFeed has got venture capital money in addition to they don't do display ads. Or maybe they do some display ads, but they always traditionally did, native advertising. So nobody's really managing to make the case. You know, BBC, obviously, which dominates that space and has huge amounts of traffic. I was talking to somebody who works at BBC and said, I've never written anything that's had less than 1 million page views. Imagine, Stephen, traffic raining from the sky. And I talked to someone else who worked at the BBC who said, well, I wrote blogs for the BBC website. And basically the only difference between whether there was any point to me doing them or not was whether or not they went on the homepage. Because it was like, if they went on the homepage, literally everyone in the world read them. If they didn't, then they died on the vine. Like that is the muscle of that. But that is provided by as a result of pooling together an enormous number of license fees.
Well, I think so. I'm optimistic about, quality journalism and our survival in the paywall. The thing which does keep me up awake at night is local journalism, because I made this point at the Bath Literature Fest where I spoke recently, and I said, well, look, in terms of the number of people we need from Bath to subscribe to the NS to make it a success, that is far smaller than if I am the editor of the
Bath Chronicle.
I need to subscribe and allow me to do proper investigation into whether or not the council is any good. Or, you know, or to take, say, Hackney, where I live, right, where Hackney now has an opposition of five Conservative councillors. Bluntly, the only reason why it's as many as five is because of Labour's anti-Semitism problem, right? The only, you know, Stamford Hill West and Springfield, the wards with the largest numbers of Jewish voters from the Charedi community clustered together.
But yeah, so, I remember I interviewed Margaret Hodge last week for Week in Westminster, and she was talking about her time in Islington Council, saying it was just, you know, all the battles you had were internal.
Yeah.
So like, it was just, they just weighed the vote. Yeah,
and the only accountability message you have are, and actually we're lucky in Hackney, we've got the Hackney Citizen and the Hackney Gazette, which is actually a very good local paper. But because obviously it's an area with a lot of deprivation, in the long term, is, you know, can Hackney support good, hard-hitting, investigative local journalism? Possibly not. And because, bluntly, yeah, it feels unlikely that we are going to kick the Hackney Labour Party out anytime soon. I actually have a lot of time for our council, and, you know, obviously we are.
You love your mayor.
Yeah, I love my mayor. Yeah, and we deal with Hackney Homes a lot because they are our leaseholder.
I was on the jury last year for the Paul Foote Award that Private Eye do, and that was won by a local paper. It was about hidden homelessness. It was about the state of B&Bs and people being moved around temporary accommodation. Really great journalism grounded in a community. And actually, I always think about, I think a lot, it was the anniversary of Grenfell and Grenfell Inquiries opening. You know, would things like that, would have more and punchier local media reporting on things like cladding and people that are living in homes of substandard quality, could that kind of thing have been prevented?
Well, yeah.
I think you will see more of that kind of stuff happening if there is no one to report on it.
Look for Rahman is a really interesting example of this, right? Look for Rahman is not the only mayor or council leader
To face questions
about their... But he is the only mayor and council leader where Ted Geary, excellent investigative journalist and blogger, lives. And bluntly, because one of the positive things in London now is we have the arrival of On London, David Hill's blog, which obviously if you subscribe to one media organisation, it should be us. But if you live in London and you subscribe to two, the second should be On London.
Yeah, and Private Eye, which does Rotten Boroughs, is those are the kind of last places that are left. And you know,
but I am a lot more troubled about the existence of local journalism. I think the answer is clearly going to have to partially be subsidy. The problem, and I guess, wow, we're at the point of the podcast where Stephen does a boring bit about electoral reform. The difficulty is, as our political system is currently constituted, right?
Oh God, okay.
You need to fund, in my view, you need to fund investigative local journalism. The market will not provide and bear the level of scrutiny you need. Now, if you have a non-majoritarian system, and it's grandfathered in with various quangos that are protected in certain ways, then I think that money can be spent to effectively investigate the government without people kind of going, oh, lovely grant you've got here. Shame if something happened to it. In our present system, bluntly, I do not believe in a first-past-the-post democracy. Grants to investigative journalism are not also going to come with difficult caveats, right? If you have a mixed or a coalition government, right, it's just harder for everyone's interests to align.
Look at the aftermath of Leveson and the kind of complete partisan bun fight that's turned into.
Yeah, this thing is, why did Leveson 1 happen? Well, because there was a
massive scandal that meant that you couldn't, that having an inquiry into it was the least worst option for the government at the time.
And also crucially, because there was a party in that government which made up the majority, which its interests did not align with the other governing party.
Mm.
Why is there not going to be a Leveson 2? Well, because that does not apply anymore. So yeah, I think in terms of the media ecosystem, I'm optimistic other than at a local level.
I feel more optimistic about us and what we're doing. I think that's been, I think you have to, you know, we are a specialist publication in some senses. We offer something different to newspapers. I think the idea of a morning print newspaper now begins to feel quite oft outdated, but you know, you have got old print titles like The Guardian that have transitioned extremely well. I should say, like, nepotist alert, like my other half does edit The Guardian website. So
I was gonna say, that's a big life change you'd be keeping keeping from the rest of us.
So if I was going to slag that...
You and Kath are very happy.
but if I was going to... No, I'm just saying, if I slagged off the Guardian website, that would be... Because he listens to the podcast too, so that would just be an epically bad idea.
Does he not... Does he not get enough of you? Well, that's another question, but does he not get... Does that... Yeah, like, and on that bombshell.
Thanks, Stephen. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush, recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. As we said, the New Statesman now has a paywall. You get a certain number of articles free every month, but after that, we're going to ask you to register, and then if you want to read even more, to subscribe. Why not? Because otherwise, Stephen will have to do more adverts about razors, and frankly, the man can only shave so many times.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.